Starting slide 6, right?
Yes.
Okay. Obviously, this is a view of a plasma membrane, which actually just a little bit of it. Yeah. You mean the blinds?
Oh, yeah, the blinds.
I could crack the glass if you want me to. Is that enough?
Yeah.
The entire cell would be huge here. We're just looking at a tiny slice of the plasma membrane. There's a bunch of proteins here because there are some proteins that are outside, some proteins that are inside. But the main focus of the slide is about the proteins that are part of the membrane. In other words, the membrane-bound proteins. As far as categorizing them is concerned, you can categorize them. One way that you can categorize membrane-bound proteins is by how far they stick through the thickness, more or less. So there are one category is the so-called peripheral proteins. You see one example right here labeled. Peripheral means of the periphery, which is the edge of something. A peripheral protein is a membrane-bound protein, but notice that it's associated with only one face or the other, either external or internal face, only with those heads, in other words. A peripheral protein does not stick into the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. The other ones that are shown here, well, I guess there are two peripheral proteins labeled. All the other ones that are part of the membrane, though, all the other membrane-bound proteins, are not peripheral. They are integral proteins. That's the second major category. But what this slide fails to actually distinguish between, they didn't think about this when they drew the art, I guess, is that there's two ways that a protein can be integral. Integral, by the way, just means it's part of the integrity. It's really connected very well with it. And so integral proteins do extend into the thickness where the tails are. But, as I said, that can happen two ways, only one of which is shown here. All of these integral proteins in this example happen to stick all the way through the thickness. So they are certainly integral proteins, but they are even more specifically called transmembrane proteins, which simply means across or through the membrane. Not all integral proteins are transmembrane, though. These ones just happen to be. So you could easily imagine an integral protein that is not transmembrane. It would stick just part of the way through the thickness. So it would still be exposed to some tails, but it wouldn't go all the way through. And depending on what the function of the protein is, which we'll look at categories of functions in a minute, it would make sense for any given protein to either be peripheral or integral or even transmembrane. The other thing I'll say about this, go ahead.
Do the ones that don't stick all the way through have a special name, or are they just integral?
They're just integral. While we're on this, though, let's look at these carbohydrates. These little green cartoons represent carbohydrates. They are oligopeptides, really, as shown here, which means several but not many monosaccharides hooked together. Anyway, the point that's important as far as this slide is concerned is that the exterior-facing part of a plasma membrane often features a bunch of these carbohydrate markers in multicellular organisms. This is a single cell, but in a multicellular organism, obviously, there are many cells. And in a multicellular organism, it's important for the overall organism, it's important for the individual cells of that organism to recognize the other cells that are also part of that same organism as being self cells, part of the individual, rather than foreign cells that could be invaders, for instance. And so these sugars, these carbohydrates that are attached to either proteins or lipids, serve as little ID badges, really, to alert the other cells of that same organism. If the sugar, the carbohydrate part, is attached to one of the phospholipids, then the whole thing is called a glycolipid. Glyco simply means sugar. If they're attached to a protein, it's a glycoprotein instead. Well, let's look at 7. And here we have what kind of protein? Well, any protein is at least one polypeptide. But how would you describe this one based on what I just told you?
Transmembrane.
Right, this is a transmembrane protein. This particular example happens to be a channel, which we'll talk more about in a minute. But this is showing you the protein in ribbon form, like we've looked at before. Remember I said that the usefulness of a ribbon is it shows you that it's a single polypeptide with two ends. So this is all one sequence of amino acids. There's just two ends to this single ribbon. But it shows you the importance of secondary structure. We talked about the four levels of protein structure in the other chapter. And secondary structure refers to whether that polypeptide has alpha helices or beta pleated sheets, and if so, how many and where are they? Well, this has a lot of alpha helices. Each one of these corkscrew shapes is one alpha helix. And by arranging it that way, with a bunch of helices, kind of like the staves of a barrel, you have a hollow interior. And that's why I said this is a channel protein. It forms a little hole in the membrane through which certain things can pass, specifically things that can't directly get through the phospholipid bilayer. I mentioned before that a living cell cannot have its plasma membrane be made out of nothing but phospholipids because certain things will be blocked, and some of those things have to be gotten into the cell or out of the cell for the cell to remain alive. That's a major reason, not the only reason, but a major reason why you need membrane-bound proteins in a complete plasma membrane so that certain things can get into and out of it.
Can splices, the peripheral membrane,
or you mean polar as far as charge is concerned? Not the entire protein necessarily, but the part that is in contact with the heads is. Oh, actually, I'm glad you asked that because that's the other thing I wanted to say about 7. Well, no, I'll use a different slide that's even better pictured it. Talk about that. Let's go on to 8. Here we have 6 major categories of functions that membrane-bound proteins can perform. It's a pretty diverse set of functions. Now, any individual membrane-bound protein is going to do just one of these functions. But there's all kinds of different membrane-bound proteins. So collectively, they have these 6 categories. The first of which shown here is transport. Refers, of course, to moving things around, but really specifically what they're referring to here in transport is transmembrane transport, meaning transport through a membrane either into or out of the cell. Think back to when I gave you a lecture in the lab, but it was both lab and lecture material a couple weeks ago. That's when I told you that there are 3 major mechanisms, 3 major transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. What are those 3 categories? Remember? Right. Passive transport, active transport, and vesicular transport. And vesicular transport is kind of the weird one of the 3 because, yes, things do move into or out of the cell, but they do so without actually ever passing through a membrane. So vesicular transport is not transmembrane transport, technically. The other two, though, are passive and active transport, which we'll look at in greater detail in a minute here. Well, passive transport doesn't necessarily require a transport protein, which is what these things are called when they're functioning for transmembrane transport. They're specifically called transport proteins. But if the particle you're trying to move into or out of the cell, in other words, through the membrane, is one of those things that cannot easily pass through the phospholipid bilayer itself, then you will need a transport protein. So let's pause here temporarily and talk about what kinds of things would be able to get easily through the plasma membrane, the phospholipid bilayer. Well, there's two major criteria that have to be met if you are a particle that has a chance of getting directly through the phospholipid bilayer. One is that you have to be small enough. If it's too big, then it's just not going to get through. Being small enough, though, is not enough. You also have to be sufficiently nonpolar in order to get directly through. Now, why does that make sense?
If they were polar, they would be the tails would not let them through.
Right. If you're polar and you try to get through the thickness, you're going to be exposed to these nonpolar tails. And polar things don't like to be around nonpolar things. So those are the two things you have to fulfill if you have a chance of getting directly through the phospholipid bilayer. You have to be a small enough particle and nonpolar. Things that are either too big or too polar or both therefore need the help of a transport protein of some sort. And hopefully it makes sense to you that if a membrane-bound protein is operating as a transport protein, it has to be a transmembrane protein, right? If it doesn't stick all the way through, it's not going to be able to get the particle to the other side all the way. All right. We'll talk more about transport proteins in a little bit, but let's go to these other functions. Enzymatic activity. Meaning some membrane-bound proteins operate as enzymes. We haven't talked in detail yet about enzymes. We will in the next unit after this upcoming test. Yeah. That some membrane-bound proteins act as enzymes. That's how they function. And an enzyme, in general, is a biological catalyst. Catalyst is a more general term from chemistry, which is simply some substance or particle that speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant. And therefore, it doesn't get changed. You know, chemical reactions, as we've talked about, change reactants into products. Catalysts aren't reactants, and they therefore don't get turned into anything. But they do help, in some way, reactants turn into products. So they drastically speed up chemical reactions. And virtually all of the thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions that occur in your cells, or any organism's cells, requires the help of enzymes to catalyze them. And that's why a big fraction of your genome, meaning all of your genes collectively, which represent all the proteins that you can make, a big fraction of that is dedicated to telling the cell how to specifically make enzymes. In other words, a big fraction of your overall number of proteins that you're able to produce are specifically enzymes. That's what they're working as. Well, most enzymes function as catalysts fully inside the cell, where most of the stuff is happening, right? But some of them are bound to the membrane. That's the only distinction. A membrane-bound protein is still doing the same job as an enzyme that would be fully inside the cell. It just happens to be connected to the membrane for whatever reason. Okay, next is signal transduction. And transduction is the noun form of the verb transduce, which means to change from one form to another. if you are a stereo nerd, for instance, loudspeakers are called transducers because they transduce the AC electrical signal that is sent to the speaker into back and forth movement, mechanical movement of the cones to create the pressure waves that you eventually hear. In signal transduction in cell biology, what that refers to is that one signal causes something to happen which causes a different signal to be created. In other words, some sort of message is delivered from a first messenger to a so-called second messenger, and eventually, after however many messengers, something happens as the end result in a cell. Well, we've talked about signals in general, chemical signals in general before, right? What do you know about what is required for a chemical signal to work? Of what?
Of the receptor.
Right. In other words, no chemical signal has any effect in any cell unless it binds to a receptor that is specific for that kind of signal. Well, the signal itself could be any of several things. It might itself be a protein, in fact, usually is, in the case of hormones, for instance. But the receptor is always a protein. And using hormones as an example, they're not the only chemical signals, but it's a familiar example. You have hormones running through you that get broadcast throughout the body, because they get carried by the blood and all living cells get a blood supply. So all of the cells are receiving signals, but not all of them have any knowledge that the signal is even there, because some of the cells don't have the right receptors for those signals. Well, hormones, chemically speaking, can be classified based on what kind of molecules they are, and you can have two broad groupings. They're either lipid-based or protein-based. And the majority are protein-based. Lipid-based hormones, because they're lipids, are nonpolar. Lipids in general are nonpolar. And they, therefore, can slip right through the phospholipid bilayer. I'm talking about lipid-based hormones, which is not what's shown here. They still need to bind to a receptor to have any effect, though. The point is that for lipid-based hormones, the receptor proteins that can receive them are found inside the cells. And they come right into the cell, and then they bind to the receptor. Well, the protein hormones cannot get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. They're too big. And so they still work. They still cause an effect, something to happen in the cell that wouldn't happen if they weren't there, but they never enter the cell. In essence, they just knock on the door to deliver a message, and then whoever answers the door delivers it from there. That's what we call the second messenger. And that involves a membrane-bound receptor. These receptors can't be inside the cell because the signal can't get into the cell. Well, just like transport proteins have to be transmembrane, so do membrane-bound receptor molecules for chemical signals that can't enter the cell. Here you have to think back to what I talked about as a consequence of ligands binding to proteins. What is a ligand? The ligand isn't necessarily a protein. It usually isn't. That means it often isn't. But a ligand can be just about any kind of particle that binds to a protein. All right? Now, what did I say is the general consequence of the binding of a ligand to a protein? Well, conformation means shape. But what happens to the conformation? It changes, right. That's the general consequence of any ligand binding to a protein. The protein itself changes shape. Well, in this case, the ligand is a signal molecule, and the receptor protein is the protein. If this signal is present, which it wouldn't always be, but it happens to be right now. And this receptor is the right kind with just the right shape for that signal, then there will be binding, and therefore there will be shape change in the receptor protein. But if this were not a transmembrane protein, if it's sticking only halfway through the thickness, it would still receive the signal, right, if it's facing outward, and it would still change shape when the ligand binds to it, but nothing inside the cell would ever know that happened because it's not sticking all the way through. Since it is transmembrane, though, the shape change that occurs when the signal binds to the receptor site is such that the part of the transmembrane receptor protein facing the interior of the cell also changes shape. And therefore, it can interact with things differently in the cell because of that shape change. That's like answering the door and receiving the message and then giving that message to something else inside the cell. That's signal transduction. Next up is cell-to-cell recognition. I was talking about this before in the other slide. In a multicellular organism like we are examples of, it's important for the individual cells to recognize each other as being friendly, part of self versus non-self. And that's where those glycoproteins, the sugar part acting as a little ID badge, come in. You actually have two different kinds of membrane-bound proteins functioning here. One, the glycoprotein itself is just functioning as the ID badge. The other protein on a different cell has just the right shape to recognize that sugar, and therefore it's able to recognize the ID badge. A very similar thing is happening as far as recognition based on shape in intercellular joining. I shouldn't really say recognition, but it's two proteins coming together because of their shape. In this case, though, it's not about recognizing self cells. It's about keeping these two cells connected in a tissue. Tissues are collections of cells. Well, the cells need to be held into place. And then the last category is attachment of the cytoskeleton to the extracellular matrix. This is more or less strain relief, for the purpose of strain relief. Do you know what I mean by strain relief? For instance, you have strain relief on a lot of cords coming out of devices because they get tugged. And so there's some strong point where tugging won't actually break it. But if you imagine that these are extracellular proteins, get pulled on, they are connected to this membrane-bound protein, and that therefore would pull on that membrane-bound protein. And if that's the only proteins you had, then if the force is great enough, it would, at best, tug the protein out of the membrane, which would be bad enough. Or it could also just burst the whole membrane, which would, of course, be even worse. But instead, there's also a connection between the membrane-bound protein and proteins inside the cell making up the cytoskeleton. So that if it does get tugged on, the force will be transferred to the inside and the membrane itself will be spared any damage.
So, for example, the other structural proteins
that keep it from... That's right. Okay, now to 9. This is not actually new information. I've talked about this before, but it's good to see a picture of what I was describing. What we see here is movement of vesicles from one organelle to another. Some vesicles are budding off of the rough endoplasmic reticulum because those are complete packages, as complete as far as the ER is concerned. It's done its job of modifying the proteins, packages them in vesicles, sends them to the Golgi complex, which receives the vesicles by, basically, vesicles meld into membranes because they're made of the same stuff. That dumps the now already modified proteins into the Golgi, and then it does its job of figuring out where they need to go, where they'll be packaged at the other end, the shipping part of the Golgi, the trans face, into new vesicles made out of Golgi material. And that's what you have right here on where the numbers 3 and 4 are. That's all old stuff that I've already discussed, but notice that there's a couple kinds of proteins in this little package. Some of them are entirely within the vesicle. And at least this one, kind of shaped like a dumbbell, is embedded in the vesicle membrane itself. Okay, the reason that matters will become obvious when you imagine, and you can picture in the cartoon, that this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane. When that happens, first of all, the vesicle's membrane is now just part of the plasma membrane. But the proteins that were fully inside the vesicle are therefore going to get spilled all the way out of the cell. This is how a cell exports proteins so that they can do their job outside. Proteins can't be built outside the cell. It requires internal cellular machinery to do that. But some proteins operate outside the cell, so they need to be built and then exported. This is how. But notice that the dumbbell one that's embedded in the membrane is now going to be part of the plasma membrane, since the membrane becomes part of the plasma membrane, the vesicular membrane becomes part of the membrane. All right, so this is how a cell embeds proteins into its plasma membrane, and they therefore become membrane-bound proteins. But this is continuously changing. The reverse can happen as well. A cell can take up a little vesicle from the plasma membrane, taking that stuff out of the plasma membrane. It's always being adjusted according to what the needs are currently in the cell. Okay, 10, 11, and 12 I've already talked about. It's in a different recording, so I'm not going to go through that again, but just remember that is test material still. That brings us to 13. Here we are looking at a protist, which is kind of a catch-all word nowadays. It used to be used differently, but now it's kind of an informal grouping within biology. Protist means any eukaryote, so a member of eukarya, the domain, that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So all three of those, animals, plants, and fungi, are members of eukarya as well. But there's all kinds of other things in eukarya. All of that stuff collectively, other than the animals, plant, and fungi, are called protists. So prokaryotes aren't protists, and neither are animals, plants, and fungi. Okay, well, some protists are unicellular, like this one we're looking at. Some are multicellular. Some are huge, like brown algae, size of trees. But this is a unicellular protist. And more specifically than that, it is an aquatic protist. Now, what does that mean? Right, aquatic means in the water. But so does marine. What is the difference between aquatic and marine? Which one has salt? Yes, marine means seawater. Aquatic means freshwater. And those are drastically different environments to live in, right? Based on tonicity. How would you describe marine compared to aquatic based on tonicity?
Marine is less foggy compared to freshwater.
Okay, and that's right. And therefore, what kind of tonicity are you talking about? Right, marine is more hypertonic. Freshwater is more hypotonic. Of course, freshwater is not pure water, but it has far fewer solutes than salt water. All right, now not only is this an aquatic protist, but just like us animals, it does not have a cell wall. All it has is its comparatively flimsy plasma membrane. And we've already talked about what happens to an animal cell in a hypotonic environment, right? Which is what? Lysis, Right. Lysis, it does, you're right, it gets lysed, but the process is called lysis. That kills the cell, like the red blood cell we use as an example. Well, if you lose a red blood cell, no big deal. You lose billions every week. You lose, actually, billions every day and make new ones. But this is a unicellular organism. If it loses one cell, that is a big deal. It ceases to exist, right? Nevertheless, it, even though it doesn't have a cell wall, it lives in fresh water. It's aquatic. So it lives its whole life in an environment in which osmosis is trying to bring water in. And there's no way it can stop it. Water is going to come in, and that would normally kill it, except that it has this specialized organelle called a contractile vacuole, which is a little bit like the central vacuole of a plant that you looked at today, meaning when water comes into the cell, it can also go into the vacuole, and it will expand the vacuole. But when the vacuole, the contractile vacuole of this protist, stretches to a certain point, that triggers proteins just like in your muscles, microfilaments, in other words, to interact with each other and contract that contractile vacuole, which is why it's called that. And that will squeeze the water out. It just does this over and over, like kind of like the beating of a heart, but it's operating as a bilge pump to prevent it from exploding. Okay, 14. Now we need to talk more about transport proteins, which is just one of those six major functions we looked at. I already told you that not everything requires the help of a transport protein, but anything that is big enough, polar enough, or both will require the help of a transport protein. And as far as how they function, in other words, a functional distinction allows us to classify any given transport protein in one of two categories. There are channel proteins, as you see on the top here, and there are carrier proteins. Now, they're both transmembrane proteins, as any transport protein has to be to get the thing all the way across, whatever it is. The difference is that a channel protein is just a tunnel. And this is a cutaway view, so you can see the interior of it. It's just a protein that forms a little tunnel. Now, the tunnel is still specific, meaning that only certain things can pass through it. And there are some channels that are just always open, like this. There are some channel proteins that have a little gate at one end or the other, so-called gated channels. But even for a gated channel, when the gate is open, the channel is just like this. In other words, the channel itself does not change. It's just an open tunnel. A carrier protein, on the other hand, doesn't have a tunnel all the way through it. And that's what makes it different. A carrier protein operates by changing its conformation in order to get the transported particle through the membrane. Now, both of these pictures show you particles moving into the cell. That doesn't actually matter as to this distinction between the two types. Either one of these could be used to move things out of the cell as well. It just happens to be moving it inward here. All right, but a carrier protein is a good name because carry means that there's an attachment, a temporary attachment. The solute particles bind to some part of the carrier protein. They have to be just the right type for that kind of carrier protein. Well, this is another example of a ligand binding to a protein. The ligand in this case is the solute particle, but it's the same consequence. When it binds, there's a conformational change of the protein. And that's why it's called a carrier protein, because that shape change is such that it will open up to the other side of the membrane, either out or in, depending on which way it's going. And that's how the particle gets through. All right, so that's just the distinction as far as the two kinds of transport proteins are concerned, yeah.
So, and then the carrier protein one takes ATP. Channel, does it take some still or just less?
Well, I'm not accepting your premise. In fact, I was just getting to that in my sentence, in my next sentence. It is true that some carrier proteins use ATP, but not necessarily. But let's actually start at channel proteins. Since a channel protein is an open tunnel, make sense of it in your mind on common sense terms that a channel protein can never be used for active transport. Active transport moves things against the concentration gradient, right? The gradient itself is trying to move things down the gradient. You know, if you have a barrel full of water and you just punch a hole through it, the side of the barrel, that's not a good way to get more water into it, right? It's going to just come out down its gradient. Similarly with a channel protein. If you have a channel protein, the gradient is going to cause diffusion, passive transport down the gradient, and that's what's going to determine the direction. It's going to go wherever the solute particle has lower concentration, either into or out of, depending on the situation. So channel proteins have to be used for passive transport only. A carrier protein, on the other hand, can be used either for passive transport or active transport. The fact that it's changing shape does not mean that any extra energy is being added, necessarily. Remember that passive transport still requires energy. It's just that the energy is already built in the form of the gradient. The gradient supplies the energy. So, in this case, you can see that the outside has a higher concentration than inside. There's a gradient in place. Remember, there's two requirements for diffusion to take place. You have to have a gradient, and you have to have a way to get from A to B. In this case, the way to get from A to B is the carrier protein. But since it's going down a gradient, that gradient is what's providing the energy, and therefore, it's using this carrier protein for passive transport. Even though it's changing shape, it's doing so because of the gradient. Well, if you want to use if you want to force something against its gradient, take it from where it's already scarce and put it to where it's already plentiful, then hopefully it makes sense that you have to use a carrier protein. You couldn't just use a gaping hole. You have to grab onto that thing and force it in the opposite direction from what it wants to move in based on its gradient. So active transport requires a carrier protein. Is that all clear? All right, well, let's look at an example of an active transporter. This is slide 15. Before I get to this particular example, let me just say in general that if a carrier protein is used for active transport, not all of them are, as I just said, it could be used for passive. But if a transport protein is being used for active transport, we can call it an active transporter, but usually we call them pumps. By analogy with water pumps, right? It's easy matter to get water to go downhill. But you can try as many times as you want, it's not going to flow uphill. You have to force that to happen. You have to supply energy to the pump, whether you're hand pumping it or it's an electrical pump, whatever. It's an energy source. That's why we call active transporters pumps. This is just one of many examples of pumps. In fact, this is two pumps in one because this is moving two different kinds of particles, both against their gradient. And this is the kind of pump that is most prevalent in animals. There's many, many quadrillions of these in your body, continuously operating as long as you're alive. In fact, there are so many of them that by some estimates, 40% of the food you eat goes into just continuously powering these pumps your whole life. There are plenty of other kinds of pumps in your body as well, especially in the kidneys, for instance. But the most prevalent ones are the sodium-potassium exchange pumps, which is what the name of this is. Because the two different kinds of particles that are being moved here, each against its gradient, are sodium, Na, sodium ions, I should say, Na plus, and potassium, K plus. Which, those symbols do make sense, because another name for sodium is natrium, and another name for potassium is kalium. That's how they got the symbols.
Is sodium and potassium only one potassium pump?
By this pump, yes. Yeah, this is specifically the sodium-potassium exchange pump. And pumps often use as their outside source of energy that active transport by definition requires, they often use ATP. It's not always the case that ATP is the source of energy, but it is often, and it is in this case, as you see. But notice, first of all, it's a carrier protein. It has to be a pump. And this is all the same protein, but at different parts of the cycle. It's initially opened up toward the inside, and sodium ions inside the cell can therefore bind to it. That causes a shape change. And with the help of ATP, that lets off, drags the sodium against their gradient. Now, you don't see the detail here. They should have drawn the gradient. You don't really see any sodiums outside. But in your body, sodium ion concentration is much higher in extracellular fluid than in the intracellular fluid. So this pump is taking sodium from where it's already scarce, and it's stockpiling up outside the cell. As a matter of fact, the reason that the extracellular fluid has a high concentration compared to the intracellular fluid is because the pump establishes that gradient and maintains it. Okay? So it drags sodium out, and then it also then drags, while it's outward facing, it drags potassium against its gradient, because the gradient for potassium is just the opposite. There's a high concentration inside your cells, there's a low concentration outside. So potassium wants to diffuse outward, it just can't. Because it's an ion, it can't get right through the phospholipid bilayer. It gets dragged against this gradient into the cell using the energy of the phosphates that came from ATP, and then it snaps back into its original shape, and as long as there's more ATP available, it will keep going, a continuously operating pump. And that's why it uses so much of your energy. Every individual cycle requires ATP expenditure. Okay, now to 16. We talked a little bit about the importance of this slide already. You see passive transport and active transport being compared here. Well, passive transport can happen any of three ways. If the particle being transported is small enough and nonpolar, then it can go right through the phospholipid bilayer. That's simple diffusion, not involving any transport protein. First of all passive transport is diffusion, remember, right? Even if it's osmosis, which is a special case of diffusion. But the second possibility is that the particle type is either too big or too polar to get through the phospholipid bilayer directly, and therefore it needs the help of some sort of transport protein. It's still diffusion, though, because we're talking about passive transport. It's going down its gradient. The gradient is supplying the energy. Since it's still diffusion, but it requires the help or facilitation of a protein, we call that specific process facilitated diffusion. In other words, facilitated diffusion is a passive process that requires the help of a transport protein to get the particle down its gradient through the membrane. And it doesn't have to be into the cell. It could be the opposite direction. The direction depends only on the direction of the gradient. And then the third possibility is that this is still a facilitated diffusion, but this kind of particle actually uses a carrier protein instead of a channel. Active transport, on the other hand, is always going to involve a carrier protein, and since this carrier protein is operating for active transport, this is an example of a pump. This one is not a pump because it's acting passively. Okay. Now, speaking of active transports, starting in 17, this slide and the next is going to hopefully explain the difference between what I'm going to call primary active transport, even though we usually just say active transport. I'm going to call it primary active transport, though, to distinguish it from what's in the next slide, which is called secondary active transport. All right? When we get to that second slide, I'll make the distinction. But here, let's just talk about this proton pump, which you also have proton pumps in your body in various places, including the kidneys. But plants don't use sodium-potassium exchange pumps like animals do. Their most abundant pumps are proton pumps. Still a pump, though, meaning that it moves something against its gradient as long as you supply it with some sort of energy. In this case, it's ATP that's powering it. What is a proton, also known as? A hydrogen ion. So remember to equate in your mind the word proton, the phrase hydrogen ion, and the symbol H+. They all mean the same thing. By the way, the proton is a good example of the fact that you need to fulfill both criteria to get through the phospholipid bilayer, because a proton is smaller than almost anything, right? It's not even as big as an atom, so it's plenty small enough to fulfill the criterion, that size criterion, but it still doesn't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer because it's beyond polar, right? It's a hydrogen ion. It doesn't want to be around those tails. Okay, now back to the pump. This is a proton pump because the particle being pumped against its gradient is hydrogen ions, H+. And the ATP provides that energy. This is just like our sodium-potassium exchange pump, except it's only pumping one type of particle. This brings up another couple definitions, by the way, that I need to get out of the way while we're talking about that. Any given transport protein can be categorized based on how many particle types get transported and also in which directions. So this proton pump pumps just one kind of thing, protons. And therefore the process that it performs is called uniport, uni meaning one, of course. And the pump itself could be called a uniporter, a transporter of just a single type of particle, in other words. All right. Some pumps, though, just like the sodium-potassium exchange pump we already looked at, can move two different kinds of particles at more or less the same time. So they're not uniporters. They are examples of co-transporters. The process would be called co-transport. The actual pump would be called a co-transporter. But that's a general term. It doesn't tell you anything about the direction the two things are going, right? So there's two subcategories of co-transporters because there's two possibilities. A co-transporter could move both of its different kinds of particles in the same direction as each other. It could move them both into the cell, for instance, or it could move them both out of the cell. The two particles move in the same direction, in other words, and that would be called symport, or the pump would be called a symporter. The other possibility, though, of course, is that the two different kinds of particles are getting moved in opposite directions from each other, like in the sodium-potassium exchange pump. That is called antiport. Sim means together, anti means against. Okay.
Uniport and miniport, can you explain the difference to
them? Well, we're looking at one right here. A uniporter is a pump that moves just one type of particle. And this is a uniporter because protons are the only types of particles being moved here. In this case, this proton pump is arranged so that it moves hydrogen ions or protons out of the cell. All right? And you can see the gradient, right? Well, the gradient exists because of the pump. Protons are being taken from where they're scarce and they're being stockpiled where they already are plentiful. That created the gradient to begin with because of the expenditure of ATP at the pump. And it also maintains the gradient. All right, as the pump continues to operate.
So, follow that. But the co-transport pumps, do they have to have both of the ones that they're transporting to work, or can they do like one at a time?
That's a good question. There might be examples of ones that if there's just one type, it will operate, but it won't do any good, basically.
Okay.
But it could there could also be that both are required. It would just be on a case by case. No, just the opposite. And this is what I was just about to say. As this pump operates, it creates the gradient. And what do you know about a gradient? Well, the gradient is the difference, right? And gradients are sources of energy, right? They can cause passive transport. Well, once the gradient is created at the expense of ATP, that's active transport doing that. Now that you have the gradient in place, these protons want, so to speak, to diffuse passively back into the cell, right? Because the gradient is in place. The gradient, remember, is the tendency for diffusion to occur, but it's not enough because you also have to fulfill the criterion of being able to get from A to B, in this case from outside to inside. So they want to because of the gradient, but because they are so charged, they can't get through directly through the phospholipid bilayer. All right? But that is active transport, is what we usually just call it. I'm calling it primary active transport because what makes it primary, in other words, is that the external energy source, which in this case is ATP, is directly spent at this pump. Okay, now let's go to 18. And the proton pump we just looked at is this same one. Of course, there are thousands of copies of it in the entire cell, but we're looking at just one in isolation. The new information here, though, is that we have a different pump right next to it. This one is the so-called sucrose proton co-transporter. Now, I just told you a little bit ago that co-transporter is relatively vague. What specific kind of co-transporter is this? Well, all transport proteins are transmembrane. It's a symporter because both of the two kinds of particles, sucrose and protons, are moving in the same direction. Okay, unlike the sodium-potassium exchange pump, which moves them in opposite directions. All right. Now, anyway, back to the reason this sucrose proton co-transporter is important. What isn't drawn here sufficiently to show you, but I'll tell you is true, is that there is a high concentration of sucrose. Sucrose is the main disaccharide that plants use to store their sugars for energy and to transport it to other parts of the cell. For instance, to the roots. The roots don't see any sunlight, so they can't feed themselves, but they have to live. The leaves produce the sucrose and then transport it to the roots so that they can eat it. And we know it as table sugar. Anyway, what is not shown here is that there is a high concentration of sucrose inside the cell. There's a low concentration outside. And therefore, just from sucrose's point of view, the gradient is facing outward, right? Sucrose would like, because of that gradient, to diffuse out of the cell. But it's too big to go directly through the phospholipid bilayer, so it's locked in a sense, okay? Well, it's being moved, sucrose is being moved by this co-transporter against its gradient, taking it from where it's already scarce and putting it to where it's already plentiful. So that means sucrose, in this example, is being pumped. Whenever you hear the word pump, you should know that what is being taken place is active transport. But notice that there is no ATP powering this co-transporter. What is the source of energy to drive the pumping of sucrose? Right. The source of energy is the proton gradient. This is a good example of what I've told you before, when starting in the lab, when I said that a gradient is a form of stored energy. It's potential energy that can pay off, do some work for you. In this case, the work consists of moving sucrose against its gradient and dragging it into the cell. All right? What happens at a molecular level is that the co-transporter can hook on to, can recognize both of these particles. They both temporarily attach. But the protons that are coming through this co-transporter are diffusing, notice. All right? They're diffusing down their gradient. They're just coming back into the cell because that's the only place on the membrane where they can get through. They don't care where they get through. The gradient just wants them to get it back in. The only place they can do that, though, is through the co-transporter. And when that happens, the shape change that results is such that it drags sucrose along for the ride, but sucrose is going against its gradient in that process. So the diffusion of hydrogen ions is what powers the pumping of the sucrose. Well, if you run out of ATP, this co-transporter will still work for a while, notice. But eventually, once enough protons come in, there will be equal concentrations inside and outside of protons. And therefore, there is no more tendency, there's no more gradient, no more tendency for protons to keep coming in, and they will stop dragging sucrose in. So the pumping of sucrose depends on the gradient of protons. This is why it's called secondary active transport. Because the outside source of energy, which is required in any active transport, is not spent directly at the transporter. Instead, it uses a gradient that is established by the primary active transporter, which in this case is the proton pump. All right, any questions on secondary active transport? Okay. That looks like we only have one slide left then, which is 19. We've been talking about active and passive transport, which are two of the three categories. Here we look at vesicular transport. And vesicular is simply the adjective of vesicle. So all vesicular transport involves a vesicle somehow. It's the broadest term. Vesicular transport is movement of something into a cell or out of a cell using a vesicle. But you can break that down into subcategories. First of all, you can subcategorize vesicular transport based on the direction of the transport. If it's vesicular transport that is moving something into the cell, we call it endocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, endo means within. The opposite direction, vesicular transport to move something out of the cell, is exocytosis. Notice those two words don't have anything to do, they don't specify what is being transported. They just care about the direction. Yes, using a vesicle. Okay, those are the two major types of vesicular transport. We can subdivide endocytosis itself, though, based on what kind of stuff gets moved. It's endocytosis, so it's inward movement. But if it's inward movement of solid chunks, like this brown thing that's being endocytosed, Then we call that phagocytosis. The PHAG here means eat. Like macrophages are things that eat chunks. Okay? So phagocytosis linguistically means cell eating, by analogy with us eating, what we call it eating when it's relatively solid things that we're putting into our mouth, right? Well, you can use the same process, use a vesicle to bring something in, but instead of bringing a solid chunk in, you're just taking a little sip of the liquid environment. And that's called penocytosis, which is cell drinking by analogy. It's the same process. It's just instead of a chunk, you're bringing in molecules in the liquid phase. Okay, now the only thing I never mention here is on the slide below penocytosis, which is receptor-mediated endocytosis. It's still endocytosis, as the phrase indicates, but it's a little bit different from the penocytosis above it, for instance. There are some cells that are more or less continuously undergoing penocytosis. They're just taking little sips intermittently throughout their life, not really knowing what's there. On the other hand, there are some cells that are not going to bother making a vesicle and taking a sip or trying to eat unless it's first sure that the correct thing is there that it wants to get into the cell. And the way it knows whether it's there or not is by using receptor proteins. These Y-shaped red things are proteins, membrane-bound proteins that have just the right shape to recognize a specific thing that is sometimes there, but not always. If that thing is there, which in this case are the purple triangles, that's another example of a ligand, it will bind to the receptors, and that will tell the cell, okay, it's there now, kind of like getting a bite on a fishing line, and that is what's going to then cause the invagination of the plasma membrane, the in-pocketing, which forms the vesicle. Other than that, though, it's still endocytosis. And that is the chapter, and therefore the unit. So don't forget your Scantron form. And also remember, you don't have to wait. As soon as I get here, you can start. Just don't come in until you're ready to start. And when you come in, just be quiet, because people might already be working on the test. Any questions before I turn off the recording? All right, then enjoy the weekend of studying.